entitled The Crucifixion of Truth, because truth is a big issue in the postmodern debate, and one of the more difficult ones for us as Christians to engage with, since we believe in an objective and an absolute truth that's been revealed from God, and postmodernity is characterized by a lack of confidence in all such absolute truth claims. Well, as you will see, I try to engage with that a bit, but to set it in the context of a discussion of the Passion narrative. So that's where you need to turn in your Bible, to John chapter 18. I actually read substantially more than I'm going to read to you now, or actually we had a dramatized reading of it back in my own church. But to save just a little time, I'm going to read from verse 28 through to verse 38 of John 18. Let's hear God's word. Then the Jews led Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, the Jews did not enter the palace. They wanted to be able to eat the Passover. So Pilate came out to them and asked, "What charges are you bringing against this man?" "If he were not a criminal," they replied, "we would not have handed him over to you." Pilate said, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." "But we have no right to execute anyone," the Jews objected. This happened so the words Jesus had spoken, indicating the kind of death he was going to die, would be fulfilled. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Is that your own idea?" Jesus asked. "Or did others talk to you about me?" "Am I a Jew?" Pilate replied. "It was your people and your chief priests who handed you over to me. What is it you have done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is from another place." "You are a king then," said Pilate. Jesus answered, "You're right in saying I am a king. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." "What is truth?" Pilate asked. John and Bill sat glued to the television screen. Match of the Day was on, and the two soccer teams which John and Bill supported with almost religious devotion happened to be playing each other, Arsenal and Manchester United. There were only a few minutes of time left, and the score was still nil all. Suddenly, the Manchester United star, Dave Beckham, surged up the right wing and played a beautiful cross into the Arsenal goalmouth, where Andy Cole volleyed the ball past goalkeeper Seaman into the back of the net. The mounting hum of the Manchester supporters erupted into a roar. John leapt from the couch and began to cavort around the room, waving his arms like a native invoking rain. John was, needless to say, the Manchester United fan. As he looked once more back at the screen, however, his wild dance froze in midair, and the ecstatic grin on his face turned to a blank stare of disbelief. "The linesman has his flag up for offside," observed the BBC commentator dispassionately. "Beckham is protesting, but the referee is shaking his head. The goal has been disallowed." John groaned with disappointment, and then began to thrust an accusing finger at the screen. "What's the matter with that referee's eyes?" he demanded. "Anyone could see that pass was okay."
"It looked offside to me," volunteered Bill, looking considerably relieved.
"Well, you would say that, wouldn't you?" retorted John. "You haven't been practically born and brought up at Arsenal. I'm telling you, we was robbed. That was a goal, fair and square." Bill shrugged his shoulders.
"The ref didn't think so," he replied, with just a trace of smugness in his voice.
"And that's what counts, you know." "Rubbish," insisted John indignantly. "What counts is the truth, and the truth is that was a goal." "Well, was it? Or wasn't it?"
You will say, how can I judge, Roy? I wasn't there. And soccer isn't my game anyway. Which is fair enough. But suppose you had been there and soccer was your game. Would you have been in any better position to determine whether John or Bill were right about that pass? I mean, no doubt the BBC commentators went on to debate the issue at length on that edition of Match of the Day, with lower slow-motion replays from multiple camera angles and expert interpretation of the rule book of association football. But do even they have any right to say whether it was a goal or not? John, you remember, insisted that what counted was the truth. But when it comes to disputed goals in a football match, where does truth lie? It's an interesting question. And it has far-reaching implications in our late 20th century world, for to quote the title of a recent book, truth is stranger than it used to be. We used to think, like John, you see, that there was an objective truth out there that was accessible to any impartial, rational mind. It was the essence of the scientific method to determine that truth. And once it was established, it couldn't be questioned by any sensible person, since it was an indisputable fact. But our confidence in that kind of rationalistic certainty is rapidly evaporating at the end of the 20th century, isn't it? The arena of scientifically established facts is shrinking. We no longer have a public domain of objective truth to which appeal can be made. We only have the TV presenter's analysis and the prejudices of the man in the street and the referee's decision. Truth is no longer a fact, it's an opinion. At least, that's how a lot of people see things these days. Take the person I had an argument with yesterday. It's actually 2 weeks ago now, but I'm reading you the text just as it was. She was a highly articulate, intelligent young lady, and she'd taken exception to a remark I made in my sermon at the wedding we had here yesterday. We'd been talking about 5 minutes, I suppose, and we weren't getting very far with our arguments, and at length she came out with a sentence that I must have heard several hundred times in the last few years. "What you're saying may be true for you," she said, "but it isn't true for me." That sort of sentiment comes close to being platitudinous these days, isn't it? It's the way arguments always seem to end up. You're not allowed to say to the other person, "I think you're wrong," anymore. That's intolerant. To be politically correct these days, you have to affirm that they're right to hold their opinion on the matter, but insist that you have an equal right to hold your opinion. It's a bit like John saying to Bill, "Well, that pass may be offside as far as you're concerned, but it isn't offside as far as I'm concerned." The referee may have the official authority to determine the score, but he can't determine the truth in the matter either. No one can. The truth is inaccessible, lost in a confusion of equally valid perspectives and mutually contradictory opinions. This, of course, is what post-modernity is all about. In many ways, the emergence of virtual reality in the computer world is powerfully symbolic of what's going on in our culture today. Truth is now increasingly regarded as something self-manufactured and provisional. It no longer seeks to constrain consent with the imperious assertion, "This is a fact, you better believe it." It issues instead the much more modest invitation, "This is a nice idea, why not try it for size?" Postmodernity is therefore relativist and subjectivist, and it has brought with it a very radical kind of scepticism. I saw on a student's wall a few months back a poster with a large portrait of a philosopher on it, and underneath it said, "Descartes said the only things he was certain about were his doubts." But how could he be so sure? Yes, that's postmodernity for you. We're not even sure about our doubts any longer. We've lost all feel for truth. And what it's resulted in, of course, is not just atheism, but pandemic gullibility. G.K. Chesterton commented years ago that when people stop believing in the truth, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. And that's exactly what's happened these days. Postmodernity has rejected Cartesian skepticism and embraced instead the eclectic gullibility of New Age. Believe in anything you like. Mystic crystals, poltergeists, magic, reincarnation, UFOs, transcendental meditation. If it helps you feel more emotionally integrated, if it develops your imagination, if it puts you in touch with your innate spirituality, then go for it. Postmodernity rejects all authoritarian, grand, unified theories of truth with a capital T. and it offers you instead the philosophical equivalent of Legoland. Everyone's free to gather whatever pieces they like and build them into their own do-it-yourself Disney truth to play in. And I suppose if life were a game like a game of football, if it were only goals in a football match that were in dispute, then maybe it wouldn't matter too much. The trouble is, I was talking to that particular young lady at the wedding about Jesus. She didn't like it, and I don't blame her. Jesus is profoundly disturbing, especially if you share the postmodern perspective of that young lady. Did you notice, for instance, that outrageous claim he made in our reading in verse 37? For this reason I was born, and for this I came into the truth, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. Talk about politically incorrect. Jesus insists, you see, he has something to offer far stronger than mere personal opinion here. He says he offers truth. And by that he clearly means sovereign truth. A truth of such weight and authority, it gives him the right to call himself our king. It gives him the right to control our decisions, our plans, our very lives. Everybody who's on the side of truth listens to me, he says. I can well understand that young lady jibbing at such an idea. But interestingly, instead of saying, no, I reject Jesus' claims, this young lady, you see, in typical 1990s fashion, wanted to cast our debate in the form of a legitimate difference of opinion. It may be right for Jesus to be your sovereign, she said, but that doesn't mean he has to be mine. But what if his claims to being the Son of God are true, I protested, and that's when she came out with that dreaded sentence. That may be true for you, she said. It isn't true for me. As I say, she's far from alone these days in defending that point of view, and in a way, I sympathize with it. I mean, it is self-evidently so that none of us has infallible access to absolute truth. It would be utter arrogance for anybody to suggest we did. But does that admission commit us to a slippery slope from which there is no exit until we slide through the tap door marked total skepticism? Does it mean we have no access to any kind of objective truth at all? I mean, maybe I'm being naive about this, but surely that pass the other night was either rightly or wrongly disallowed. I mean, it was either a goal or it was a goal. Really, the truth is out there, isn't it? Even if Bill and John argue about it. Their argument is about reality, not about some illusion in their minds. Truth may be stranger than it used to be these days, but it's surely going too far to suggest we don't believe that truth exists anymore. I mean, if we did believe that, how would we ever try anybody in a court of law? The whole business of justice depends upon being able to make the distinction between true testimony and perjury. It depends upon a court being convinced beyond reasonable doubt. But if truth is as inaccessible as people like that young lady seem to suggest, even that sort of qualified certainty beyond reasonable doubt must always elude us. Reason can never escape from doubt. And every human judicial decision, therefore, must be fundamentally unsafe on such a view. I think that's what makes this part of the gospel story that we just read so especially interesting. Because, of course, John is here recording for us Jesus on trial. First before the law of the Jews, represented by Caiaphas the high priest, and then before the law of Rome, represented by Pontius Pilate. And before each of these courts, Jesus protests his innocence and insists he has done nothing but witness to the truth. Yet the tragic outcome is that instead of being vindicated, these two courts sentence him to death. There's an irony there that John wants us to reflect upon, you see. The irony of a world which conspires in the crucifixion of the truth. How does it happen? Why does it happen? Well, I want to suggest to you that John's story is framed to give us two vital insights into that question. And they're insights which I think are of vital relevance to our elusive quest for truth at the end of the 20th century. The two insights are these. First, We crucify truth because of prejudice. The prejudice of minds that are too sure they already have the truth. That was the first thing that led to the crucifixion of the truth in Jesus' case. The prejudice of minds that were too sure they already had the truth. And John's second insight is this. We crucify truth because of cynicism. The cynicism of minds that no longer believe truth is findable. That's why Jesus was crucified. The cynicism of a mind that no longer believed it could find truth. Stay with me while we look at those two insights together for a while. First, prejudice. The prejudice of minds that are too sure they know the truth. Just look back at chapter 18, verses 19 to 23 again, where Jesus stands before the high priest. See how he speaks there in verse 20. I've spoken openly to the world, he says. I always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby struck him in the face. Is this the way you answer the high priest? He demanded. If I said something wrong, Jesus replied, testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? I guess we could have hoped that of all people, the religious leaders of Judea would have recognized the moral and spiritual pedigree of Jesus. But sadly, all the gospel witnesses agree that it was in fact the Jewish hierarchy, that the visible church of the Jewish community, that more than any other body was responsible for Jesus' death. It was they who got him arrested. It was Annas and Caiaphas, the first century equivalent of the archbishops of Canterbury and York, who personally pressed charges against him. It was all, of course, a kangaroo court. They knew, as Jesus did, that such judicial proceedings were irregular. According to Jewish law, you could not try anybody after dark, and you required the evidence of independent witnesses. Without a corroborative evidence, even a confession of guilt was not sufficient to condemn a man according to Jewish law. That's why Jesus here demands that they bring in the witnesses. But their response to this perfectly proper, even legal demand, you see, is to stoop to the bullying interrogation techniques of the Gestapo. They slap him round the face. By comparison, Jesus is commendably self-restrained and dignified, don't you think? I'm only asking for a fair trial, he insists. Is that such a crime? Now, we know from the other three Gospels that much more transpired at this hearing with the high priest than John records here. False witnesses were indeed wheeled in, and the entire Jewish council met, and eventually Jesus is put under a solemn oath, to which he has to reply to the direct challenge, are you the Son of God? And in his reply he affirms, I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the Almighty and coming in the clouds of heaven. Whereupon they convict him of blasphemy and sentence him to death. All this John has left out, a detail no doubt that he feels his readers already aware of, because he's writing one of the last Gospels to be written. Mark and Luke probably are already in their hands, and they know these details. Nevertheless, it is the same essential picture he's describing for us, isn't it? A malicious prosecution without a shred of proper legal process. And it's quite clear this court had made up its mind about Jesus long before his arrest. This judicial hearing was not to determine what justice demanded, it was to determine an outcome they had already affirmed and decided upon. You notice what they say in 19 verse 7, speaking to Pilate, we have a law, they say. We have a law, and by that law he must die. Ironic that, of course, because the law they're referring to is the law of Moses, the law of the Bible, the law of God. But how inadequate the law of God now seems, wielded as it is by this prejudiced jury. But that is how it often will be, of course. When people are convinced they already hold unchallenged title to the truth. Blinkered religious orthodoxy can find no space to give unbiased consideration to a man like Jesus. He claims to be the Son of God. That's heresy, that's blasphemy. The law says death for such a crime. And no tinge of self-doubt could be allowed to interfere with their certainty on the point. It's always dangerous, you see, when people are too sure they already have the truth. and that they are the appointed guardians of that truth. The very word truth itself becomes distorted in such hands into a weapon of oppression, as the law of Moses did in the hands of these high priests. There was a time, of course, when the Christian religion operated in just such an oppressive fashion in Europe. One thinks of the Spanish Inquisition. One thinks of brave Galileo, persecuted because he dared to suggest that the earth moved around the sun, when the ecclesiastical referees of medieval Catholicism had already decided that was offside. Would that those of us who belong to the Protestant tradition could claim that we displayed a more commendable model of open-mindedness, but sadly, the reformers were responsible for their share of persecution too. And for precisely the same reason. They were too sure they had the truth. I don't know if you saw, incidentally, the film The Crucible on HBO the other night. It's a very fine play by Arthur Miller, telling that horrifying tale of the Salem witch trials. A classic case from Protestant history of a community that was too sure it held the truth. Of course, the Salem witch trials were just one localized example of that paranoia that often ends up crucifying truth. It's no accident, of course, that Arthur Miller wrote that play in the early 50s when the McCarthy era was at its height. The 20th century has seen its share of witch hunts, too. I wish I could tell you that Bible-believing Christians had learned the lessons of history and were free from that kind of repressive, knee-jerk reaction, but sadly, intolerance of one kind or another still prejudices many Christian minds, we have to admit it. That's why the word fundamentalism has obtained such a nasty taste in the minds of the world generally. Now, the only safe way to oppose error, if error you suspect is being made, is by refuting that error. Never by repressing it. See, refutation demands self-examination. Refutation means you have to examine why the person says what they're saying and whether and why you hold what you hold. Refutation is an exercise of the intellect. Repression is an act of power, of the will. It's to the shame of the church that it has used its power in history, particularly in the 16th and 17th centuries, to silence those who challenged its version of the truth. And insofar as our contemporary postmodern culture seeks to unmask that kind of ideological authoritarianism, it has to be applauded. The irony, of course, is that these days, the weapons of intellectual intimidation are being wielded not by the church. The authority of the church has long since waned. No, the people who display the intolerance these days are postmodernist philosophers. Even postmodernist laypeople, like that young lady, who was clearly very shrill in her opposition to me, saying things about Jesus she didn't like. In a subtle way, you see, there is a conspiracy of academic terrorism in the air these days to silence those who do not subscribe to this subjectivist, relativist, pluralist version of political correctness that now prevails. The truth will get mangled by these people just as much as it has been mangled in the past by ideologues. This is the first reason the truth always gets crucified, when people are too sure they already have it. Could that be our problem? Some of us here who call ourselves Christian, perhaps, but who in our bigotry and narrow-mindedness actually have more in common with Caiaphas the high priest than Jesus of Nazareth. Or some of us perhaps who are militant non-Christians. We know the Bible is a load of nonsense, and nothing that preacher can say, nothing the Bible itself can say, nothing that Jesus can say is ever going to convince us otherwise. Bang, bang, bang. It isn't the sound of nails being hammered, I hear, is it? Crucifying. The prejudice of minds who are too sure they already have the truth. That's why the truth gets crucified in our world. But there's a second reason that John says truth has a bad time. Cynicism. The cynicism of minds who no longer believe they can find the truth. Look at those words of Pilate in verses 33 and following. Are you the king of the Jews? Is that your own idea, Jesus says, or did others talk to you about me? And I, a Jew, it was your people and your chief priests who handed you over to me. What is it you've done? My kingdom is not of this world, says Jesus. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews, but now my kingdom is from another place. You are a king then, says Pilate. You're right to say I'm a king. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. Now listen to Pilate's reply. What is truth? He asked. What lies behind that cryptic parting question? What is truth? Is this the question of a man who is contemptuously skeptical, like Caiaphas, who sees Jesus as a dangerous fanatic? No, I don't think so. Now, this is the wistful question of a cynic. A Roman who perhaps in his youth dreamed of finding some truth to live by, but had long since given up that hope, and is left now only with the agnosticism of perpetually unanswered questions. What is truth? It's quite clear, of course, that Pilate was convinced of Jesus' innocence. He knew this was no subversive, plotting revolution against the state. Pilate had interrogated dozens of such men. Jesus didn't fit into that category. It was painfully obvious this man had never wielded a sword in his life. And as he himself said, he didn't have any followers who were willing to put up much fight against his arrest either. In any case, if he was a subversive, you can be jolly well sure there's no way the Jewish council would have surrendered him to Roman justice. They'd have made a hero of the man. Now, this fellow's crime had to be something to do with religion, not politics. Pilate knew enough about these Jews to conclude that. And having established that, one might have hoped that Pilate would have insisted upon Jesus' release from custody. Three times, you notice, he pronounces him not guilty. Three times he tries to release him. But that being so, why do we read in 19 verse 16, finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified? If three times Pilate determines him not guilty, why does he end up there? The answer, I suggest to you, is all tied up with that cynical question, what is truth? Because as we said at the beginning, once the courts of a land stop believing in the accessibility of truth, the very idea of justice loses its meaning. A world without truth is a world where right and wrong can no longer be distinguished. It's a world, in consequence, where political pragmatism triumphs over moral principle. There's a little quip, a little piece of graffiti going around Cambridge at the moment, which I quoted at this point. I hope you won't be offended by it. It goes like this. George Washington couldn't tell a lie. Richard Nixon couldn't tell the truth. Bill Clinton can't tell the difference. That is post-modernity all over, isn't it? We don't know the difference between truth and lie anymore. We don't know what telling a lie is. And it's at that point, of course, that post-modernity exposes the essentially irrational and incoherent root that lies at the bottom of it. Few generations have been more self-righteous than ours. We're always contending for justice. Justice in Northern Ireland, justice in the Middle East, justice in Yugoslavia, justice in the Third World, justice for Tibet. We hail the protesters of Tiananmen Square and elevate them to the status of martyr saints. But if there is no truth, then those brave students of Tiananmen Square were martyred for nothing. In a world without truth, there are no causes worth dying for any longer. There's only the law of the jungle. Survival of the fittest. Look after number one and do others before they do you. There's only Bill Clinton's version of truth. The truth that says, I'll survive to the next election, to the next vote. Of course then Pilate hands him over to be crucified. He's a classic postmodern political pragmatist. Truth, insofar as the word meant anything for Pilate, was determined by sociological consensus. The people had voted. That's all that mattered. There is no truth, there's only opinion. The art of politics is to align yourself with the opinion of the majority. If that means there must be abortion on demand, then let's have abortion on demand. If that means all paedophiles must be lynched, let's lynch all paedophiles. If that means Jesus Christ must be crucified, let's crucify him. You notice the way in this account, Pilate seems to hop backwards and forwards between the Jews and Jesus, like a comedian, really. He plays the role of a negotiator seeking a political compromise rather than a judge seeking to adjudicate justice. First he passes the buck to the Jews and tells them to try Jesus, and they refuse. Then he offers an amnesty to a criminal, but they prefer Barabbas. Finally he has Jesus flogged and presents his humiliated and bloodied figure before the Jews to try to disarm their antagonism, but still they're not satisfied. Crucify him, they scream. And to his shame, Pilate did. His political career was at stake, you see. And for the sake of that career, he was willing to crucify the truth. Are we? Oh, I know we're not politicians. I guess we've never condemned an innocent man to death. I hope not. But that cynicism which informed Pilate is not rare among us, is it? A couple of years ago, I received a letter from a Cambridge student who once attended my church, was a very key member of the Christian Union in the University InterVarsity chapter. He wrote to tell me why he felt unable to call himself an evangelical Christian any longer. The reason, he said, was he had found evangelical Christianity, quote, too self-assured, too reluctant to accommodate other people's ideas, too narrow-minded, too dogmatic, too unfashionably certain in this uncertain world. I wrote back to him and told him I sympathized with his disillusionment. I told him that I too was sometimes disturbed by the excessively defensive and rigidly doctrinaire evangelicalism in some of the churches that I knew he'd mixed with since he'd left Cambridge. I told him frankly how I sometimes found myself embarrassed and frustrated by the bigotry and the obscurantism of some of my ministerial colleagues who used the phrase "the Bible says" like a weapon, in an irresponsible way, supporting a completely unwarranted authoritarianism in matters which really ought to be left to the conscience of the individual believer. I told him that in my experience there were far more claims to infallibility in evangelical churches than have ever been issued from the Vatican. And I succeeded in my letter in disarming some of his hostility. Just a few months ago, he wrote back to me again and told me the real reason he'd given up on evangelicalism. He's gay. He wants to live a gay lifestyle. I've given up on Jesus, he told me frankly. I'm reading Michel Foucault these days. That couldn't be the real reason all of us embrace cynicism. Not that we're all gay, of course, but that we have a moral agenda underneath our philosophical presuppositions. The reason we want to jettison objective truth isn't deep down philosophical. Could it be deep down ethical? I have my suspicions about that. One of the uncomfortable things the Bible says, you see, is that Jesus was crucified because of the sinfulness of the human race. For sin is not a category that a truth-denying world can make any sense of. Sin speaks of a righteous God who holds each and every human individual to account for the use they make of the moral freedom with which he's endowed them. Sin is about moral responsibility. And in a world without truth, there is nothing and no one to be responsible to. But the Bible does insist. It was this factor of moral responsibility which more than any other lay at the root of what happened to Jesus. We crucified the truth that day, says the Bible, not because we didn't believe in truth, not because we didn't believe deep down that the truth was in Jesus. We crucified the truth that day because in our rebellion and self-will we resented the threat which that truth placed upon our freedom of choice. He was crucified for our sins. But still, that crucified truth offers itself to us, you know. A parable. The traveller stood by the signpost, weary and perplexed. Around him, radiating out in all directions, were innumerable paths. But mist cloaked the hillside, thick and impenetrable. And the signpost was so weather-beaten it had become quite illegible. "Which way should I go?" he asked himself. "I want to find the way to the Fountain of Truth. But there are so many alternative tracks. Which is the right one?" As he pondered the problem, three other travellers came up behind him, journeying the same road by which he'd arrived. "Excuse me," he said to the first, "can you tell me the way to the Fountain of Truth?" "Huh," granted the other scornfully, "you don't still believe in that rubbish, do you? These roads all lead nowhere. All that talk about a Fountain of Truth is so much mythological claptrap. If you take my advice, you'll pitch your tent right here by the signpost and make the best of what you've got." The traveller's face fell at the sceptic's words, but brightened a little at the sight of the second man coming up the road behind him. "Excuse me," he said, "can you tell me the way to the Fountain of Truth?" This man shrugged his shoulders. "Ah, who can say," he said. "Myself, I am an agnostic on the question. Maybe it's this road, maybe it's that one. You can't possibly prove which is right and which is wrong, you know. The important thing is to be tolerant and open-minded. Feel free to choose whichever path you want, old man. I wouldn't dream of trying to influence your decision on the matter." The traveller thanked the agnostic for his advice, though privately he had hoped for more precise guidance. Perhaps the third man would be more helpful. "Excuse me," he asked again, "can you tell me the way to the Fountain of Truth?" This time his fellow traveller smiled benignly in reply. "It is an unnecessary question, my friend," he said. "All roads lead there. They only appear to go in different directions, you see. Out there in the mists, they circle back on one another and converge at your desired destination. Follow whichever you wish. You will get there in the end." The traveller frowned, unconvinced. His battered old map indicated the presence of cliffs in the area, down which an erring walker might easily fall if he took the wrong path. But which is the right one? He sighed with frustration and bewilderment. Then, suddenly, out of the mist, a fourth figure appeared. Unlike the others, he did not come up the road which the traveller had used to arrive at the signpost. Instead, he came down one of the other tracks, and a steep and little trodden one at that. "Excuse me," said the traveller once more. "Could you possibly help me? I am looking for the Fountain of Truth. One person has told me there's no such place, another has told me to be open-minded on the question, and a third has told me all roads lead there. Can you tell me the right way?" "Indeed I can," replied the stranger. "I'm afraid those you've spoken to were just guessing, for they've never been to the Fountain of Truth, you see, and can only speculate about the route. I, on the other hand, I live there. I am the truth. Come follow me." And as he held out his hand to lead the traveller, he saw there was a nail print in its palm. Did he take the hand? Did he take the hand or stay by the signpost? Why don't we take that hand of Jesus? Could it be we actually prefer our indecision by the signpost? Could it be we're actually scared of the commitment of choosing that route? Could it be we fear that this Jesus, by his imperious sovereign truth, is going to constrain our lives in a straitjacket and rob us of our freedom? Fools that we are. Don't you realize? Jesus represents crucified truth.
Crucified truth coerces nobody. Crucified truth bullies nobody. Crucified truth tortures nobody. Crucified truth addresses itself to men and women in their freedom. Men and women who are aware that they don't know the truth. But men and women who are not so cynical that they will not believe the truth when it holds out its hand.